is going on? It is Adam. Welcome back to Bringing It Backwards, a podcast where both legendary and rising artists tell their own personal stories of how they achieve stardom. On this episode, we had a chance to catch up with John Smith over Zoom video. We had John Smith on the podcast 3 years ago now. And at that time, he had released the album The Fray. So this time around, we had a chance to, you know, kind of recap a bit on John's story about where he was born and raised. John was born in Essex and then moved at 6 months old, landed in Dartford in the UK, spent most of his time there until he moved to Liverpool to attend college. He started off playing piano at 4 years old, and by seven, he was winning local piano competitions and obviously a very, very talented musician. Moved from piano onto drums and then eventually started playing guitar. At around 16 years old, he became really involved in theater. He thought he was going to be, you know, a theater actor. Ended up getting really sick, was in a coma. And during that time, he started to focus back on the guitar, surround himself with musicians, and then quickly realized that's the path he wanted to take. He ended up attending college at Paul McCartney School in Liverpool. He was one of five that had that opportunity to showcase one of his songs in front of Paul McCartney. He's got an incredible story about meeting him and then meeting him again at the graduation. He talks about the early open mic nights he'd play and playing at different restaurants, eventually going on tour. We hear about his relationship with John Martin and touring with John Martin for a number of years. And after John Martin passed away, he appeared on the tribute album to John Martin. We also talk a lot about John's new album, which is called The Living Kind, an album where he discusses a bunch of a personal crisis that him and his family had to go through over a very short period of time. And we hear about how this album is very therapeutic and kind of moving forward and dealing with a lot that had happened in his life. And he has a really amazing music video for the title track, The Living Kind. So definitely check that out. We do talk about it quite a bit as well. You can watch our interview with John on our Facebook page and YouTube channel at Bringing It Backwards. Be amazing if you subscribe to our channel, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Bringing Back Pod. And if you're listening to this on Spotify, Apple Music, Google Podcasts, it would be amazing if you follow us there as well and rate and review the podcast. It helps us tremendously in the algorithms and all of that great stuff.
We'd appreciate your support if you follow and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're Bringing It Backwards with John Smith. Hey, John, how are you?
All right. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I appreciate you taking time to do this.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You have a number of guitars behind you.
Yeah. I've got more off camera. I like to surround myself with them.
I love it. That's amazing. Yeah. How many guitars do you have?
I think that's a very rude question.
Oh, is it? I'm sorry.
I have a dozen or so. And then I've got a couple of banjos and other bits and pieces lying around the place.
I was going to say, you got at least, I think, 10 here in front of me.
there's what, 7 or 8 back there. I got 4 over here. I got 1 over there. I got a couple under the bed. The older ones, they live in their cases.
Ah, amazing. Yeah, I saw that you recorded the record with a really, really old guitar, correct?
Some of it, yeah. Joe Henry has a couple of Gibsons from the 1930s.
That's crazy.
Yeah, amazing instruments. They've lived several lives, and then they find their way into my hands, and you know, they get to say something brand new. I love old guitars, the way they move air around in a very different way, and each one is completely different.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's wild to think that like a guitar that old could still stay.
For sure.
You know, good. I mean, with wood and everything else, to have the action on the guitar not be like all bowed out. I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's really crazy to think of a guitar that old, like nearly 100 years old.
That's right. Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Very cool. Well, my name's Adam, and this podcast is about you and your journey in music, and we'll talk about the album as well.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Originally from Essex. Is that where you're born and raised?
I was born in Essex, right on the border of London, East London and Essex.
Okay.
And then when I was 6 months old, we moved. I ended up growing up in Devon on the south coast of England.
Oh, wow. You guys moved? Right, pretty much right away, when you're born.
A little bit of moving around, settled in Devon when I was about four. So
okay.
A lot of my frame of reference is the seaside and the beach, seagulls, you know, tourists. And then
Sure.
When I was 19, I moved to Liverpool, and then I spent all of my 20s in Liverpool.
Wow. That's cool, man. What about as far, I mean, you got a ton of guitars, but was guitar the first instrument you learned? And did you come from like a musical family, a creative household?
Yeah, my dad has always played music, and he was in the record business. So there were always a lot of records and CDs around. I started playing piano when I was maybe four. And by the age of seven, I was playing in county competitions and, you know, winning prizes as a child pianist. But And then I discovered drums, and piano kind of went out the window. And then I discovered guitar, and everything went out the window. I was about 11 when I picked up a guitar, and I realized that was the one for me. That's what I wanted to do.
That's cool that your family was so supportive of, you know, music, to put you in piano at four and to the point where you're winning competitions at seven. I have my younger son's seven, turning eight next month. And we put him on drums early on, but at that age, kids are kind of like, I like drums. Then I like dance. Now I like baseball. It's like, you kind of jump around quite a bit, but to be, you know, that disciplined, or even that just naturally talented to get to that level and at that young of an age.
I've always been quite obsessed with whatever I'm doing. I get really into it. Yeah. So I collected comic books until I was about 21, and I had to have the best comic book collection. Then, you know, I got into acting when I was about 16, and then I just wanted to be in theater companies. So I joined several theater companies. I was in the National Youth Theater, and with guitar, I just wanted to be the best guitar player that I could be. You know, I really, if I'm going to do something, I try and do it as best I can. And then, you know, when you start doing something for a living, you have to temper yourself a little bit, because you realize that you're just going to lose the enjoyment of it and burn yourself out. And actually, that's been a really useful thing with guitar, because I do it, it's my job. So my relationship with guitar is a little less obsessive now and a little more balanced, like kind of like a more healthy relationship.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, you kind of have to. At that point, too, you're probably like, I can't really jump around to be obsessed with maybe something else, or, you know, go all in on somebody else, because this is now your livelihood, I would imagine.
For sure, man.
Well, I'm curious then, I mean, to be in theater and acting and part of all of that, was that kind of the passion at the time? Was that something you thought that you were going to do for the remainder of? Okay.
I really did. I thought acting would be the one for me. I got really, really, I just fell in love with theater. And then when I was about, maybe I'd been 18 for 3 weeks, I got really sick with meningitis,
and
and I fell into a coma, and I spent a few days there in a coma, really, really close to death. And apparently doctors, my parents didn't know which way it was going to go. When I emerged from that, I had a couple of years recovering physically, and it forced me to pick a lane. If I was going to stay committed to the theater, I would just have to concentrate on that. I didn't have the wherewithal and the strength to do more than one thing. Mm-hmm. And I found, in that state of recovery, being very fragile, I found musicians and music and surrounding myself with anything guitar related, a much more comfortable place than trying to be in plays, because the intensity of small theatre production and quite often the people involved, actors are very intense people. Musicians tend to be less intense. At that point in my life, I just thought, right, I just want to surround myself with musicians. And that's what I did. And I dropped my place. I had a place to study theatre at university, and I went and studied music instead. I didn't get any grades because the illness kind of scuppered my chances of graduating with any meaningful grades. So I kind of flunked out of college and went off.
They didn't give you any sort of leeway on that? That's wild.
Yeah, not really. Not really. And I was a terrible student anyway. I was just, I was smoking too much weed and drinking too much beer, and I wasn't interested in school at all. I just wanted to play guitar. So I went and auditioned for a music college that didn't require grades. They just took you on merit. And I went to Liverpool and I studied music, and then that was me. I'd kind of found my lane, and I started gigging. You know, I started playing open mics, and then kind of got through college, did reasonably okay. And at the other side, I just went straight into playing restaurants, playing more open mics, playing as many gigs and every night as I could. I was just gigging and gigging and gigging and honing it and making sure that I wasn't scared of hecklers. I wasn't scared of noise. I was just trying to properly learn how to perform. And that was all the while I was working part-time jobs. You know, I was doing it that kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Just to back up here for a second. I mean, like, once you kind of surrounded yourself with musicians and realized, like, your sickness, and I can only really focus on one thing, and I want to pursue music. Were you writing your own music at that point? And like, when you were doing these open mic nights, were you playing original songs, or did it kind of start off in a covers way?
Yeah, I think like everyone, I was mostly playing covers. Okay. You write some songs early on, and then you write some more songs, and the further you go, they become less embarrassing and less, they make your skin crawl a little less. So after about 5 years of writing songs, I started to write a couple of things where I thought, actually, I could handle performing this. So that's what I started to do.
Wow. So it took you a while to get the courage to get up there and play your own original music?
Yeah, I wanted to get it right, man. I was always fine with covers. And when I started gigging, I was just playing instrumental kind of music. I was really influenced by Michael Hedges and Eric Roche and Clive Carroll and all the great fingerstyle guitar players. I wanted to be like them. And then I started singing. I'd always sung, you know, covers, but when I started singing my own songs, it started to kind of make sense. So then I migrated towards guitar and vocal performances. But it took me a while. I mean, it's scary at first, singing in front of people. And I wasn't a great singer. I didn't have much in the way of control. There were some notes I just couldn't hold, so I had to really learn how to do that. Mm-hmm. And I feel sorry.
I was saying, now you've got a great voice, so it all worked out.
Thanks, man. Some of those early audiences got the early version, and they probably heard some pitchy, some pretty horrible notes.
Do you recall like going up and knowing you're going to play your own original song for the first time? And was it like at an open mic, or did you just kind of throw it into your set?
I think the first one was at an open mic when I was younger. I was like 18 and I had one song. And then that was my one song for about 2 years because I couldn't write any more that sounded good. later on, I remember I wrote a song called Winter, where I put the guitar on my lap and I played it percussively.
Oh, wow.
And that song, I remember playing that in clubs in Liverpool and people going crazy because I was doing something new with the guitar. And that was real encouragement. Then I must have been 23. And I thought, okay, I've got something here. I'll keep working on this.
Did you go to, what school did you go to in Liverpool? Was it McCartney's?
Yeah.
Music Institute. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
The course, the music course itself was terrible. I think they were just nothing to do with Paul McCartney. He's a patron of the place, but I think the music staff were just making it up as they went along.
Okay.
So it was academically, I would say it was pretty ropey, but I was surrounded by musicians and like-minded people. And that was great. I came from a small town where, you know, I was the guitar player in my small town.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I was surrounded by lots and lots of great musicians. And you learn a lot very quickly in that situation, you know.
I spoke to one other person that went to that school, and they said, and I don't know if this is for every class, but they had an opportunity to go in and you get to write with Paul, like for one class or like at one moment. Did you have that chance?
Yeah, towards the end, I think they picked like five kids from the year to go in, and basically you play a song and he just gives you a little feedback.
Did you get that opportunity?
I did, yeah. I didn't get to write.
But yeah, I mean, to be able to go up in front of like probably the most important songwriter, you know, and the amount of hits he's put out, and just obviously the Beatles.
But, oh, man.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't even, if that was me, I mean, growing up on the Beatles, my sister's named after Abbey Road, and like, I would just freeze. Like, I'm not a songwriter or anything, but I wouldn't even know how to handle that.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
tell me about that, going in there to like, just, you're in the presence of a legend.
The voice of God. I mean,
yeah, 100%.
Paul McCartney, to my mind, is up there with Beethoven. He is.
Oh, yeah.
He's the greatest. But he was lovely. He was just a very tired. I think he'd just done Glastonbury, maybe. He was tired. He looked like he had not had much sleep.
Uh-huh.
And I just walked in. He went, "Hello, lad, play us a song." So I played him a song, and that was it. He asked my name. He gave me some feedback on the guitar. It was the one where I was drumming on the guitar.
Oh, wow!
And he really dug it. And then I saw him again at graduation.
Yeah, he does like the speech at the end, right?
Yeah, he does the speech and hands out the diplomas. And I was so impressed. I mean, he must meet more people than the Queen did. And he said, I walked up for my diploma and he went, "Hello, John, how's the guitar, lad?" And I thought that was so classy. He just seems like a really nice man.
That's cool. Yeah, after I talked to the other, I can't remember who it was, but I told my wife, I'm like, we need to figure out when their graduation is. We're going to go to Liverpool and just try to be there when he's there. You know what I mean?
Put on a robe and sneak in.
Yeah. Bring like the million records I have and hope that he'll write his name on one of them. But yeah, like that's so cool. I've heard, you know, to have that experience, I can't even fathom, you know, being in his presence. That's so amazing. And then from there, you obviously just did a bunch of gigging. And then what was kind of the next point? Like, did somebody see you, or like when you start working on your first records? Like, tell me kind of about those times.
Yeah. So between graduating and getting my first tour, I had about a year and a half where I just focused completely on gigging.
Mm-hmm.
So I was playing everywhere in Liverpool, everywhere I could, and I was working about four part-time jobs.
Wow.
I was working in a comic book store, I was working in a Pakistani supermarket, and I was working in a car park, and I was working pulling pints in a bar, and I got a gig playing a guitar festival. And the guitar festival paid me as much as I earned in 1 week in all my four part-time jobs. Like,
wow.
at the time it was like 150 quid. Not a lot of money, but
four jobs or this one show.
Yeah. So I got the gig, I got paid, and I quit all those jobs and I became self-employed. And then I was broke for 2 years. I may have acted a little soon, but I was just pulling it in here and there. I was going and playing restaurants, you know, cash in hand, just sitting in the corner playing a bit of guitar, that kind of thing. And then after another year or so, I was playing a show. There was an evening, The Songs of Nick Drake. And I'm a huge Nick Drake fan. So mm-hmm. I wanted to open that show. They wouldn't let me support. So I went down into the lobby of this venue and I just played Nick Drake songs as people were coming in. And they said, okay, wow. do that. We'll give you 30 quid. Fine. So I was doing that. And someone approached me after I'd finished and said, look, well, I've seen you playing around. How would you like to come and open for John Martin? And I said,
wow.
I said, I would love, I mean, the only answer to that is yes, please. I would love to do that.
Right.
I said, yes. He said, all right, you have to be in Buxton next Friday. I didn't have a car. Buxton was, I don't know, it's about 80, 90 miles from Liverpool. So maybe it's around that. I enlisted a friend and I said, look, come with me. We'll split the fee. That will cover petrol. And I went and recorded some songs in a friend's home studio. And I recorded those songs on my other friend's Apple Mac desktop machine, which he was the only person we knew who had one, right? Because we were all broke, man. And he had one. He'd been given one because he was dyslexic, so he got a government grant so that he could get a computer. So all of us just used to use this one computer to make CDs and, you know, work on. And he was like, I'm not going to use it. You boys use it.
Damn, so, and to get an Apple out of that, that's amazing.
It was a good deal, man. It was, but he was, all he did was play bass all day. So we had this kind of community computer that he'd got for free. And I went around with a packet of CDRs. You remember them?
Oh,
and I burned like five songs onto 100 discs and I drew the artwork by hand for each one, put them in plastic sleeves. Took me a couple nights. And then I opened for John, which was extraordinary. I'd never played to more than 100, 200 people. Here I was playing to maybe 1,500 people. And then on the steps outside the venue, I sold all my CDs. Suddenly I had £500 in my hand. And the fee from the gig. So I was holding the thick end of £1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, this is it. This is a business. I can do this. So I went and I spent that money on my first album. And, you know, I hired some local musicians and cut a record called The Fox and the Monk. Mm-hmm. And I released that myself in 2007.
And that has Winter on it. That you were talking about, that song you wrote early on.
That has Winter on it. Yeah.
Wow.
And so then John invited me back and I went on tour with him for 2 years. Around the UK and Ireland. Yeah. I did this tour with him. Then he did an anniversary of Solid Air, his masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and played that tour with him, and that included the Royal Albert Hall, you know, stunning.
Damn. Wow.
Stunning venues. So all the while that was happening, you know, every couple of months I would go on tour with John. In between that, I was phoning promoters. I was managing myself, basically. I had someone kind of overseeing things, but we fell out after a couple of years. That wasn't going anywhere. So I was kind of independent, looking after myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was phoning around festivals, agents, venues. I was going to Manchester and London, and I would just say, look, I'm on tour with John Martin. I wonder if I can come and play. And they'd say, sure. As soon as I mentioned that I was on the road, but, you know, especially with
him. Yeah, especially with him, right? I mean, that obviously adds a lot of validation to you as an artist.
Big time. So I kind of had an apprenticeship working with John. So I was going out and playing festivals. You know, I was going to the Green Man Festival and End of the Road and Glastonbury and playing folk clubs around the country and going over to Ireland and starting to build something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's how I got started.
Wow. And then you ended up when, you know, he passed away and you were on the tribute album for him as well.
Yeah. That was nice.
Wow. Yeah. Obviously, I mean, you put out a ton of music, and I want to take time to talk about this new album. I watched the music video for the title track, which is really a cool video. The different masks of all the different animals
and,
you know, that you pulled together. Just tell me about the album. It seems like that record or the album was also kind of recorded in a similar way to the first one, where you were just at someone you're at someone's house, right? In the producer's house, and uses, I think, his son or on the album.
Like the most extreme version of recording at someone's house, because I was working with Joe Henry, who he's got a, it's no exaggeration to say, a small cabinet filled with Grammy awards. And so
Crazy.
his home studio is beautiful, and his son Levon is a very gifted engineer and a beautiful musician. He's playing currently playing clarinet and sax with Julian Large.
Oh,
So
wow.
he's a heavy player. And so a bass player called Ross Gallagher from New York came up, and we cut this record in 4 days in Joe's music room.
And I saw that it was like freezing cold, right? Like 25 under, like that. I
Yeah,
can't even
man.
believe that.
In Celsius as well. That's not even Fahrenheit. It was
That's even, yeah. I don't even know the calculation there, but it has to be insanity. It's
it's like
like
you have to be a
32
penguin.
degrees less than that, right? Like negative, 50 something.
It's crazy, man. It was very cold. So we hunkered down, we stayed in, just stayed in the house, and we ate good food, cut songs. It was beautiful. It was really good. And I've always wanted to make a record with Joe. He's my favorite producer.
Oh, wow. And did you know him prior, or was it something that you were able to, just get? So you knew him b before going into the recording?
Yeah, I've known Joe for maybe a dozen years now, and I've played on. I met him. We were re recording with Lisa Hannigan, and then since then, I've played on four of his own records. He's a great songwriter, and I've played on the last Joan Baez record that she made, and that Joe produced that. So I've worked with Joe a bunch, but he's never recorded my songs, and we've always talked about it. And I was out visiting him. I was touring the US in 22. I stopped in with Joe, and we wrote a song and demoed it after dinner one night, and he said, there's no reason why we shouldn't make a record here. I think we can do this. So a full year later, I was there with my guitars in his music room making a record.
Wow. And did this album come together kind of quickly? I mean, to write it in a in that short, or not to write it, but to record it in that short period of time. But I was reading you kind of talking about the album a bit, and you had some stuff happen, and then this album, what came from that?
I've made a record in 2021 as a direct response to some things that happened in my life. My mother was being treated for cancer. My wife and I suffered a miscarriage that
Oh my God.
almost killed my wife. And then my dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. But the Alzheimer's thing was very fresh, and I didn't talk about that so much on that record. And then a couple of years passed, and I found myself writing songs dealing with emerging from a lot of that stuff. I'd been caring for my parents, for about 2.5 years by that point.
Wow.
And so 2 years, something like that. We moved them over. It was all during COVID. They both got really sick. So we moved them over from Spain. I sold the house, rented somewhere where I could look after them. A couple of years of mayhem, and then things started to settle. And when the dust starts to settle and you start to mix my metaphors, you look in the rearview mirror and you see things, problems moving into the past, right? When you're in the thick of them, it's very hard to make sense of it. But as they were retreating into the distance, I started to write songs again. And I was writing about moving forward, very literally about just plowing ahead and trying to make sense of things that have happened whilst firmly keeping an eye on the road. And a lot of the new record is about that, just moving forward, trying to keep your chin up, and not be too weighed down by trauma and by hardships.
Do you feel like writing this album or getting these songs out was like a therapeutic thing for you? Or did it help you move kind of forward and see that in the rear view?
Certainly, yeah. I think that's the remarkable thing about songwriting that I've really learned in the last few years. It is It is a very sort of healing process. I find it it really helps me sort my head out and arrange my thoughts. If I write a song, sometimes I won't quite know what it's about, and then a couple of weeks later, months, maybe even a year or two, I'll sing it and I'll realize, oh, it was about that. My subconscious was bubbling up and writing that song. And now, oh, okay, I see what that's about. It's so weird.
Yeah, wow. Like, has that ever happened to you? What, in the middle of a gig, you're like, okay, this just like landed on me?
Yeah, it did. It did with the song. I'm trying to figure which record that was from. I think maybe the song Undone from Headlong. I remember singing that in front of a huge crowd and my brain just going, that's what this song is about. You've just figured out what it is. And then I almost stopped playing. I was like, oh, right. Oh, God. And then you have to stay professional. Right. Get through the song. I came off stage feeling like, wow, I've just realized what something I wrote years ago that I started writing 10 years ago has just occurred to me there. It's very strange.
It's a wild process. Yeah. I've heard people talk about like pages. I don't know if you do that. Like people wake up and they just write everything out, like three pages or something of whatever's in their mind. And yeah, it's almost like a subconscious thing. I could see that. Like it just kind of pops up. You're like, oh, I didn't even know really. Yeah. You didn't know how deep that came from. And then it just kind of shows up one day and you're like, whoa, okay. That's what I was writing about.
I've been through phases of trying to do that, but it's
hard, man.
I'm not as disciplined. And now I'm a dad. So I wake up in the morning and I'm like, I'm making food and doing dishes and stuff. If I want to get into any kind of routine like that, I have to get up at 5 a.m. And because I'm on and off tour at the minute, I'm just sleeping whenever I can, man.
Yeah, I was going to say your career path is a bit difficult for that. How old is your child, if you don't mind me asking?
She's 7, man.
Okay, same age as my son.
Right.
So I know exactly how you feel, getting up and breakfast and this and school and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, and I'm finally figuring out how to balance hard work with being a good parent. Mm-hmm. It's taken me this long. I'm sure I'll be figuring out until she's 18. And
I was going to say, I'm still learning too, man. It's just happy. Yeah. You just do the best you can.
Like when I'm not touring, I'm home and I'm doing the school runs and I'm making the food and I'm cleaning and I'm trying to be a good man in the house. But when I'm on the road, I'm just touring 100%. I'm completely focused on that. So there's the older you get, the less time you have for yourself, right? So it's, mm-hmm. it's figuring out as well how to be kind to yourself with the time that you have with yourself. And that's hard when you're writing songs or doing anything creative. There's a little voice going, you know what you just did, that wasn't very good.
And right. Questioning yourself.
Yeah, all the time. So it's learning to go, actually, I'm not going to listen to that voice. I'm going to put that one on the shelf for a minute. And yeah, it's a constant struggle, man. Like Tom Waits said, right? It's the briar and the rose. And those two things are always in opposition. And you just got to find a little space between them to make it work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I mean, touring, I see musicians and like that lifestyle. When I was younger, I poorly played guitar and I was like, I want to do this. Like, this would be so fun. And then you think about the amount of shows you all are playing and night after night in this city and that city, like that would be so draining. And then having the energy to get up there and play for an hour or longer or whatever it may be. And then the next day you're in the van and then you get home and I know how busy my 7-year-old is. You're like, okay, well now it's this. Now I'm up at this time and I'm trying to do lunch and school. Yeah, man, you're burning at both ends, I'd imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's just me on the road. You know, I've always traveled pretty light. Mm-hmm. It's one or two guitars, a suitcase. And I've been on tour with bands as a session musician. And in a way that's easier because if one of you is feeling terrible, the others can kind of help you out.
Mm-hmm.
When it's just you. And if you get into a situation where you're arguing with yourself, you're in a bad spot, man. So I really I really tried to keep it simple, and the main thing is just getting out of bed when you don't want to. That's something I've struggled with all my life.
Yeah, the discipline to just be like, oh, okay, I'm not going to hit snooze because that's going to be another 30 minutes. And like,
yeah, not even that. Like, just the voice that says, don't bother getting out of bed. You're not very good at this. You know.
Oh, sure. Okay.
You just need to stay in bed and watch some TV. But you go, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to keep doing the work. I'm going to get up. I've got to get out of this hotel and get in the car or get on a plane and go somewhere and play to 20 people and not make any money, but do it anyway. It's that mentality. And compared to being a parent, it's easy, but it's it can get tough out there on tour, but also I've been up a ladder and I've carried bags of cement and I've worked in bars and I feel fortunate to be on tour, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. You said you did a demo of a song and that's what kind of sparked to work and work on this album. Did that song make the album?
Yeah, man. It's the last song on the record. It's Lily, and I co-wrote that with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. And then I was saying earlier, the music video for the title track, Living Kind, is... Well, how did that concept come about? And like, where do you find all those masks? I mean, you had a giraffe mask, the dog with the tongue out. Like, I was like, these are so rad. Like, yeah, what a great Halloween costume.
That was a little independent bookseller called Amazon.
Ah, okay.
I don't know if you have them in America. They're very, very useful.
I've heard of the company.
Yeah, they happen to sell latex animal masks. I'm really into... Hunter S. Thompson and kind of gonzo aesthetic and comedy, which you wouldn't tell that from my music, but that's kind of how I get my kicks. And I just thought, wouldn't it be fun to combine something like The Wicker Man with a kind of the scene in Fear and Loathing where all of the revelers turn into giant lizards. What's the way to do this for a very small budget? Animal masks.
So
me and my friends dressed up as animals and danced around in the woods.
I love it. I love the part where the whoever has the turtle mask just like kisses you on the cheek when you say, the thing is, the line is like, you say something about love and they're like, pop in.
I need love. Yeah.
Yeah. I need love. There you go.
That's Nick Peeney. He plays bass for Laura Marling.
Oh, wow.
You wouldn't know it. I mean, he's like one of the best bass players in the UK, and he's there with a turtle head on.
That's funny. And then you eventually have a mask. Then you've got the horse.
Yeah. I turn into the horse.
That's awesome, man. Well, yeah. I appreciate you, John. Thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with me. Oh, I think I just lost your camera.
There we go. That might come back now. Hang on. I got some...
Oh, look at that. A new angle of you.
Yeah. End of record. Technical difficulties. There we go.
Very. I love it. I appreciate your time. I have one more question for you. I want to know if you have any advice for aspiring artists.
Yeah. You know, I wrote this down the other day. I was asked these questions for a magazine. Do you mind if I recount verbatim what I wrote down?
100%. I'm sorry I gave you the same question.
No, you know, I spent half an hour thinking about it before I wrote this down. So this is useful. You've asked me something that I've had time to prepare for.
Oh, cool. So
I wrote, spend all your money on cocaine. No, I didn't. I wrote, write every day. Practice your instrument every day. Keep your eyes and ears open every day. Play as many gigs as humanly possible. Make peace with the fact that you will probably be broke. Be kind to yourself. Don't drink too much booze. Make sure you get yourself out of bed each day, even when you don't want to. Remember to read books. Fall in love as often as possible and write about it. Don't spend too much time looking at your phone.
Love it. I love all that advice. You're the first person I've interviewed, and I've done nearly 1500 of these, and you're the first person that mentioned the phone. I think that's such a cool statement to say.
I hate this thing, man. It's they're designed to make you look at them, and there's so much else to look at. So I really try and keep it at bay as much as I can.